like credits up to 95% of what the federal government would have spent. Well, we're way under the cost of what the federal government would spend. So we get reimbursed, but we have actually accumulated about $2 billion per year since the program started in 2015. And right now we're sitting on about, you know, $11 billion trust fund. We cannot use that trust fund to cover the undocumented communities. We have to submit the waiver that's directed in my bill called Coverage for All in order to be able to use future surplus funds. But again, we've garnered these funds since our program started, our essential plan program in the state. And we anticipate that we'll continue to bring in those surplus funds. And that pot of money can be used, and we got a letter from the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services that said, yes, you can use the surplus funds to cover undocumented communities. Again, two other states have gotten this approval. We should be next.
Assemblymember Gonzalez Rojas, not that I comment on women's clothes who are our guests, but I can't help but notice that you're wearing a necklace that says daughter of an immigrant. If you can talk about the significance of what this means and also the support that your bill has gotten from 100 unions, health plan providers, community organizations that have signed a letter to the Assembly Speaker Hastie urging the passage of this bill.
Yeah, this, I mean, personally, as a daughter of an immigrant, my father's from this teeny tiny country in South America called Paraguay. He came in the 60s and, you know, he came in with legal permanent resident. But I represent a district in Western Queens, Jackson Heights, East Elmhurst, Corona, Woodside, Astoria, that has such a large immigrant community and many, many who are undocumented. So as personally, as a daughter of an immigrant and someone who represents a district that has a vibrant immigrant population, many who are undocumented, many who were those essential workers who ensure that we survived during this pandemic. They were out there, you know, providing those essential services, deliveries. They were street vendors. They were people at the front lines. They deserve health care. And as was mentioned, we had tremendous support. I mean, we have everyone from the Business Council to the Greater New York Hospital Association, to countless unions, the healthcare union, DC 37, RWDSU. We have advocacy organizations. We have tremendous support. The previous health commissioner of New York State, Mary Bassett, submitted comments in support of expanding coverage for our undocumented community under this Fed waiver. So we don't understand why the governor's resistance. She said that she would work with the federal government last year because we were very close to getting this done last year. She said she'd work with the federal government. We've been working with the federal government. Then she said she wanted a letter of guidance from the federal government. We got that letter of guidance on June 6th. So that sort of fast-tracked the bill. We were very fortunate to get our Senate sponsor, Senator Gustavo Rivera, who is a big fan of the show. he was able to move the bill in the Senate. So again, there's no reason why we shouldn't get this done in the Assembly. It's really a win-win-win for the state, for our communities, with the tremendous amount of diverse support that's behind this.
Yeah, I wanted to bring in Elizabeth Benjamin again, just a quick thing, because we don't have a much time. But Elizabeth, could you give us a quick sense of what has been happening with the thousands of asylum seekers that have been sent here by Republicans in governors in Texas and Florida? What's their situation in terms of health care access?
Well, they're actually already eligible. They're lawfully present because they've, you know, registered themselves at the border. They've applied for asylum. So this surplus is really for our longtime essential workers who worked their fingers to the bones throughout the pandemic, and really for the longtime immigrant population who's already here. Many of them, as Assemblywoman Gonzalez Rojas said, are already availing themselves of the emergency emergency Medicaid program at great cost to the state of New York and the federal government. We would be saving combined $1 billion a year if we just went for this coverage for all bill and had the federal surplus funds be used instead so people could have comprehensive coverage for all of their, you know, their regular preventive health, vaccinations, everything they could then get as opposed to this episodic, willy-nilly, high-cost emergency room care. So I think Assemblywoman Gonzalez Rojas just nailed it. The time is now. We must do this. Our waiver is already pending before the federal government. All we need to do is amend it to include immigrants. The math is done. We're ready, Freddie. Let's get this done.
Elizabeth Benjamin, Vice President of Health Initiatives at the Community Service Society of New York, and Jessica Gonzalez Rojas, New York State Assembly member. Thanks so much for joining us. Next up, we look at the Minnesota miracle at Minnesota's Democratic supermajority and governor who've just enacted sweeping progressive reforms. And we'll go to Minneapolis as the Justice Department concludes police disproportionately targeted Black and Native American people. Stay with us. Running 99 and a half won't do by Reverend Sekou. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Minnesota, where the state legislature's Democratic supermajority and Democratic Governor Tim Walz just enacted sweeping progressive reforms during its legislative session, which lasted only 4 months. The series of bills is being praised as the Minnesota Miracle 2.0, as Democrats successfully codified abortion rights, protections for transgender people, driver's licenses for undocumented residents, new gun control rules, paid family, medical, and sick leave, the restoration of voting rights for previously incarcerated people. A $1 billion investment in affordable housing that includes rent assistance and stronger protections for workers seeking to unionize, among other reforms. The original Minnesota miracle was a nickname given to reforms enacted in the early 70s by a less conservative Republican legislature and then Democratic Governor Wendell Anderson. For more, we go to St. Paul, Minnesota, where we're joined by Peter Callahan, staff writer at the Min Post, who's covered all of this closely. Peter, thanks so much for joining us. Why don't you lay out what happened?
How much time do you have? You know, a lot happened. I mean, to us, and looking at this, it's less of a surprise than it is for you folks nationally, because the Democratic majorities were pretty clear early on that they were going to run most of these bills. There was some pent-up demand, actually a lot of pent-up demand. It's been 10 years of divided government in Minnesota, so neither party really got all that they wanted or even much that they wanted. So a somewhat surprising election last November delivered narrow majorities for Democrats, but it was a different kind of majority than they'd had 10 years ago in that it was also an ideological majority, not just a partisan majority. So it was one of the really few pro-choice majorities that there had been in Minnesota. Even when Democrats had control in past sessions, they weren't abortion rights majorities. So they pretty much decided a couple of things. One, they had 4 years, meaning they could lose the House in 2 years, but they couldn't lose the governor's office or the state Senate until 26. So whatever they passed could stay in place for these 4 years It's harder to rescind things than it is to pass things, and that they were going to make a list and check it off as they went. And so it was kind of less of a surprise to us here that all these things passed, and I think it was nationally.
And could you talk specifically about the housing legislation? The nonprofit organization Home Line has described the tenant-landlord law as the most substantial change in the state's history.
Yeah, I'll give them a pass on how they know what the landlord-tenant laws were like at statehood. But that sort of hyperbole is pretty common now as you go through. The landlord-tenant changes are, again, a result of pent-up demand. For all these years, anything that passed in that realm had to be a compromise between landlords and tenant organizations. And with the trifecta, a Democratic trifecta, they no longer really needed to bring in the landlord groups. And a lot of these issues were things that had passed in other states and had been proposed by Democrats in Minnesota in the last decade, but just didn't have the votes to pass. So that landlord-tenant changes were significant, but you really can't look at those without looking at the billion-dollar investment in affordable housing. A typical budget for housing in Minnesota is $150 million to $200 million in a biennium. So that gives you some sense of what $1 billion is. And that money isn't just going to build housing with both public housing and with nonprofits. It's the first ever state rental voucher system, similar to the Section 8 program on the federal level. It's first-time home buyers down payment assistance. It is a renewal of rental assistance similar to what went on during the pandemic across the country. That money is also significant, and coupled with the tenant rights bill is interesting because the landlord groups after the session were not happy with the changes to landlord-tenant law, but they're pretty happy about the billion-dollar investment because their members will see that through rent payments and other things.
And what are the potential for legal challenges to some of the this legislation?
I don't know that there's really anything that was thought to be outside the realm of the authority of the legislature. Bills sort of have all been vetted over the last several years. I'm not aware of anything significant challenging, similar to several years ago when they passed the opioids protections. The pharma definitely was going to sue and did sue, and that case is still pending. But I don't know of any litigation right now.
Peter Callahan, we were just talking to New York folks about their fight right now to get health care for all New Yorkers, including undocumented New Yorkers. In fact, Minnesota did just that. Is that right? Can you talk about health care for all there and also the issue of abortion, what was passed?
Yeah, it's that in fact, I was listening to that segment and thinking that passed here really with not a lot of attention on it. Minnesota does a system. I work the Washington legislature, so I know some contrast. A lot of things show up in omnibus bills at the end of session. So 10 big, fat, hundreds and hundreds of page bills, and things can get put into that, those bills that maybe were heard, maybe were talked about, but there was no obvious sense that they were passing. And things like health care under the Minnesota Care Program for people who do not have documentation was put into one of those bills, so really didn't get a lot of attention. What we do after session is we start going through all of these bills to find all the things that were put into those bills. They don't make the list that we wrote about on adjournment, but there's significant things, and that was one of them. And the abortion rights issue, that was really, I think it's, I'm comfortable in saying that these were abortion rights majorities. The Democrats didn't think they were going to win the majorities in either the House or the Senate. They thought the Senate Republicans would retain control, and the House DFL, I think, thought they were going to lose control of the legislature in November.
I want to bring into the conversation Robin Wansley, Minneapolis's first Black Democratic Socialist City Council member, longtime Minneapolis organizer and activist. The Minnesota governor, Tim Walz, faced backlash from labor organizers after, in May, he issued the first veto in his entire tenure, blocking a bill that would have granted minimum wage and better working protections for Uber and Lyft drivers. The veto came just hours after Uber threatened to pull out of Minnesota. Your response, Robin?
I think, you know, as Peter highlighted, what we saw at the state level and what was very crucial in delivering this Minnesota Miracle 2.0 is we saw finally the coalition, a strong coalition be built between progressive and democratic socialist elected officials, along with, you know, key grassroots groups who have been organizing for decades around some of the key demands that you mentioned, as well as labor. Labor was part of that coalition, too. And as part of that coalition, you know, we saw some amazing, you know, pieces of legislation be delivered. But we also should, you know, see this veto as a clear indicator that corporate interests still hold significant sway and influence over our state government and over a contingency of the Democratic Party, specifically the establishment wing of the Democratic Party. And that was manifested, yes, in the veto against the ride share protection legislation that would uplift workers who are doing, you know, necessary work with Uber and Lyft. But we also saw it with the nurses staffing legislation, too, where Mayo Clinic threatened to pull out billions of dollars of investment because nurses dared to say that we actually need to center the needs of our healthcare workers and our patients as opposed to the profits of corporate healthcare executives. So those were the two instances where, in light of this entire session, we saw still the establishment wing of the Democratic Party be pool to fulfill the interests of the corporate establishment in the state. And, you know, in light of that, I'm very excited, though, that my office is working with those drivers who pushed for such an unprecedented part of, you know, of legislation that will uplift this segment of workers. We're on the work right now or on the ground right now in Minneapolis to get that done here and to, you know, support our colleagues as they bring that fight forward once again at the state coming into the 2024 legislative session.
I also want to comment that Peter kept referring to DFL, which for a global audience is the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, the Minnesota affiliate of the U.S. Democratic Party. But Robin, I also want to ask you about the latest news coming as the Justice Department has accused the Minneapolis Police Department of disproportionately targeting Black and Native American people and frequently using excessive and unlawful use of force. The findings come in investigation launched after the police killing of George Floyd in May of 2020. Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke Friday.
The patterns and practices we observed made what happened to George Floyd possible. As one city leader told us, quote, "These systemic issues didn't just occur on May 25th, 2020. There were instances like that that were being reported by the community long before that."
Robin Wansley, your response as a longtime Minneapolis organizer and activist, as a Minneapolis Now city council member.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear, you know, Merrick Garland again share those findings and hearing that in contrast with talking about the Minnesota Miracle 2.0, because since George Floyd's murder, what we've experienced here in Minneapolis has been nothing close to a miracle, but it has felt like a Minneapolis nightmare under the Frey administration specifically. Under Mayor Frey's administration, which I will note, you know, the DOJ findings or investigation period took place from 2016 to 2022, the entire tenure of the Mayor Frey's administration. We also, a year ago, had the investigation be led by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights that also found that MPD, Minneapolis Police Department, had engaged in a violent, racist, and misogynistic series of patterns and practices against residents. And that investigation failed within 2010 to 2020, so about 3 years of Mayor Frey's tenure as mayor. And over the course of his entire tenure, Mayor Fry has remained the sole executive authority over MPD. And the findings have made it clear that he turned a blind eye to a rogue, violent, and racist police department, as well as, I want to say, counsel. That is noted in the Minnesota Department of Human Rights findings as well, that council members, some of those that are still there today, turned a blind eye to the police department that led to not only the events of George Floyd, but acknowledging that there is dozens of victims prior to George Floyd and even afterwards. So I want to name, and Mayor Garland said this himself, for residents here in Minneapolis, the findings that were, released from the DOJ, as well as the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, have they're not new. They're not surprising. This has been the reality of working class people, especially Black and brown and indigenous working class folks in our city for decades. And our elected officials have ignored the pleas and the cries and the testimonies of those communities when they talked repeatedly about the violence they experienced at the hands of the police. And instead, what we're seeing is a Fry administration that is still ramming through a status quo model of policing. Most recently, he's trying to push through the rebuilding of the third precinct, despite opposition from the public around that. We've had taxpayers have to fork over, more than $50 million in misconduct settlement cases that police have caused. Taxpayers have also had to pay over $60 million in workers' compensation claims that MPD officers have used as a way to flee the police department as it undergoes or are being mandated to undergo these robust reforms by now the Minnesota Department of Human Rights and the Department of Justice. So in light of that, again, none of this is new, but what I think is most important in these conversations is, again, this has happened under Mayor Fry's tenure. Mayor Fry has repeatedly shown, as indicated in these findings, that he is not competent in exercising his authority to hold our racist and misogynistic police department accountable. And as a result of that, and as a result of community members persistently organizing for a new model of comprehensive public safety that do things like what's highlighted in the DOJ report, as well as the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, like creating mental health responders, the community should be at the table for this consent decree around the DOJ.
And Robin Wansley, we're going to continue this conversation, but we have to end right now. Minneapolis City Council member, thanks so much for joining us. Also, Peter Callahan, staff writer at the Min Post. Next up, as the president's son, Hunter Biden, reaches a deal with federal prosecutors, we'll speak with The Intercept's Ken Klippenstein. His piece, What Does the FBI Have on Hunter and Joe Biden? Back in 30 seconds. By Wunderbar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Hunter Biden, the son of the president, has reached a deal with federal prosecutors to plead guilty to two misdemeanor tax charges as part of a deal that'll allow him to avoid facing prosecution on a separate gun charge. The deal caps a multi-year investigation by the U.S. attorney in Delaware, who was appointed by Donald Trump but allowed to stay in his role by President Biden. House Republicans have described the deal as a slap on the wrist and vowed to continue to investigate Hunter Biden. For more, we're joined by Ken Klippenstein, investigative reporter with The Intercept, who co-wrote the piece with Ryan Grimm, headlined, What Does the FBI Have on Hunter and Joe Biden? Ken, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you lay out the results of this case? And again, it's not the Democrats who are criticizing here. It's the Republicans who have been going after Hunter Biden for so many years.
Thanks for having me, Amy. To speak to the case, in May, a whistleblower, an FBI whistleblower, came forward to Senator Chuck Grassley, who is the top Republican on the Judiciary Committee, which oversees the FBI. And in this whistleblower's report, alleged that the FBI had something called an FD-1023. That's a type of document that memorializes tips that they get from what's called confidential human sources. That's FBI speak for informants. And according to, and you know, I should remind listeners that the information we're getting from this is from both Grassley and Representative Comer, who sits on, who chairs the Oversight Committee. So what this FD-1023 claims, according to them, is that President, then Vice President Joe Biden received $5 million in exchange for policy decisions, specifically to fire, to get fired the top prosecutor of Ukraine, who had been investigating what's called Burisma Holdings. This is one of the biggest natural gas companies in Ukraine. And the allegation is that the reason for that payment is President Biden's son, Hunter Biden, sat on the board of directors of Burisma. But what's left out in a lot of the, you know, frankly, partisan discussion about this, and that's really the reason that we did the story, was just to look at what the basic facts were, is that this FD-1023, that's just an allegation. They have not been verified, and that's something that if you look closely at the, what the Republicans are saying, the more cautious ones have conceded that.
And Ken, much has been made about the Hunter Biden laptop and the attempt to suppress it. And so the investigation apparently found nothing illegal in that laptop.
Well, it's complicated, and there are a number of investigations, and when the FBI talks about these things, they're always very vague about it. You know, they don't want to interfere with an ongoing investigation. But what was interesting about the laptop case is that, yes, you know, former Mayor Rudy Giuliani played a role in having it delivered to the FBI. They ended up investigating it. It appears from these charges, at least, that was not something that resulted in you know, prosecutorial charges. But that's something that the Republicans have been pushing very ardently to try to investigate. But there's been no information from that laptop verifying any of the allegations I described before.
And in terms of the plea agreement reached, there are some that say that even prosecution for these misdemeanors was a stretch. And of course, the Republicans are arguing that this was extreme leniency and a double standard by the Justice Department when it came to Hunter Biden. Your sense of the facts of what you've uncovered?
Yeah, there have been a number of, I saw recently quoted a public defender describing how unusual the sentence was in terms of how aggressively it was prosecuted, but we're in territory that's, you know, extremely politically sensitive and you know, very, very partisan in nature. I mean, these top Republicans that I mentioned before, Representative Comer again chairs the Oversight Committee, and then Senator Grassley, have all but admitted that you know, former President Trump is being prosecuted in the classified documents case in New York. And they've all but come out and said, you know, why don't they prosecute Biden? And so they're very explicitly connecting the two cases and not being particularly subtle about the partisan and political nature of their call for these investigations and prosecutions.
And Ken, if you can quickly say what he has pled guilty to, explain the gun and tax charges.
Yeah, so he pled guilty to the tax charges in exchange for not being prosecuted for the gun charges. And so he was in possession of these firearms at a time that he, by his own admission, was in the throes of addiction issues. And so this was basically a deal with prosecutors to get them not to prosecute on the other half of the case, which a lot of Republicans are looking at and saying, you know, look how soft they went on him. But that's a, you know, very standard procedure by which prosecutors adhere, offering lighter sentences in exchange for admissions.
And finally, we just have 10 seconds, but the U.S. attorney Trump appointed.
That's right.
Ken Ben Klippenstein, I want to thank you for being with us, investigative border reporter with The Intercept. We'll link to the piece that you co-wrote with Ryan Grimm. What does the FBI have on Hunter and Joe Biden? That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Wernup, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
The National Indigenous Peoples Day celebration is happening once again. It's a free outdoor event at Moody Park in New Westminster. It's happening on Wednesday, June 21st from 9:30 a.m. till 2 p.m. There's going to be local vendors, food and beverages, live cultural entertainment, storytelling, and many fun activities. The 2023 National Indigenous Peoples Day celebration is hosted by Spirit of the Children's Society, Kakite First Nation, and the City of New Westminster. Also supported by Shop First Nations, the Department of Canadian Heritage, the City of Burnaby, New West Record, New Westminster Teachers Union, the Arts Council of New Westminster, and Metro Vancouver.